He came out of the Moroccan desert like a prophecy gone rogue. A man of letters turned mystic. A preacher turned warlord, or maybe the other way around entirely. Morocco had won big at the Battle of Al-Qasr al-Kibir, and the Saadians were drunk on the memory still. Ahmed al-Mansur had built palaces of sugar and gold, pillaged from the Songhai Empire, obviously. But when he died in 1603, leaving behind one of the richest empires on the continent, he also left his own bloodline weaker than a beggar. His sons were tearing the empire apart like jackals over a dead lion. The Saadians were too busy killing each other to notice the empire was already a corpse. And corpses attract flies. Abu Mahali was one of those flies. And though he didn't stand long enough to make it to the history books, the records would not forget him completely. Coming straight out of the Sahara Desert, as they so often do in Moroccan history, this charismatic, uncompromising guy, ready to divide history like a sword, did not have so much as an army at first. But when he arrived with that certainty and with the kind of moral authority that does not beg to be believed, he shook an entire dynasty to the core. A madman in a turban for some, and a redeemer born from the dust for others. But either way, Morocco would somehow remember him. Welcome, history enthusiasts, to Tarikhna Lab, the podcast that makes you time travel into the millennial, often tumultuous, but oh so fascinating past of Morocco. I'm your host, Aya, and today we take a couple steps back from this scary present we live in that has us watching entire bloodlines being decimated in full HD by a poisonous state while we sip our morning coffees and go about our days. From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. Today we revisit a story behind a name you've probably never come across before in your history books, but one that truly had 17th century Morocco in a chokehold. I mean, what an era! A time when the very fabric of Moroccan society seemed to come apart entirely. An age so chaotic on the political scene that it would become known as the Maributic Crisis. And you'll understand why in a second. And perhaps that's what makes this period so haunting? A fractured land searching for meaning and a figure stepping forward to claim it. The story of every nation that has ever, at one point in its history, stood too long between glory and despair. Most of what follows is drawn from pages 323 to 341 of the French translated version of Nuzhat al-Hadi, the Chronicles of the Saadian Dynasty, written by Moroccan historian Ifrani. Make sure you check those out. But before we dive in to really understand this critical chapter of Moroccan history, we must begin this journey in the late 1500s, when Morocco still roared with imperial pride. It was truly, and I mean this without exaggeration or poetic license, one of its golden ages. And as all golden ages do, it came at a costly price. Yet, what is a golden age but a flicker before the darkness, really? In those days, Morocco stretched out like a dream too grand for today's borders to even remember. A Morocco that was drawn by the iron resolve of the Saadian dynasty, the second Cherifian lineage to climb the Moroccan dynastic ladder. Now mind you, the Saadians were not born of palaces. Instead, they rose in the early 1500s from the sand clouds of the Draa Valley in the south of Morocco, a place where men would learn early to speak with their eyes, and just as early know the weight of a sword. After a brilliant military campaign against both the Portuguese, who were invading Morocco from the Atlantic coast, and the previously ruling dynasty of Al-Wattasin, the Saadians, or Saadin, under the legendary Ahmed al-Mansur, they beheld the land together with a kind of fierce grace, protecting its sovereignty, and even extending the boundaries of the empire as far south as Timbuktu. a dazzling, if brief, renaissance. But all empires, and I mean all, especially those carved in faith and fire, eventually collapse one day, undone not by enemies, but by human nature itself. Let's zoom in. When Sultan Ahmed al-Mansur died in 1603 after nearly 25 years of rule, he left a loaded gun on the table, a succession crisis. Now, don't get me wrong, the throne did not lack aspirants, far from that. But the problem was that Ahmed al-Mansur did not name a defined successor. So, as it turned out, what Morocco had inherited from al-Mansur Dehbi, as we called him, on top of all the gold, the prestige, and the fresh memory of, like we said, a golden age, was a question. Who would be tasked to ensure this prosperity wouldn't become some exception in Moroccan history, but would turn into a rule? Who would ensure that power would outlive its architect? That sole question tore the entire empire apart. His sons, Abu Abdullah Muhammad, Sheikh al-Mamun, Zidane, and Abu Faris, among many others, did not step into his legacy. Instead, they dismantled it. Each started to lay his own claim to the throne, each convinced that legitimacy was his by birthright or divine favor. As a result, a drawn-out civil war broke the entire empire at the joints. The country was being rewritten into rival zones. The fracturing process was as messy as it could have been. Power was becoming a game of shifting alliances. I mean, when it comes to Moroccan history, honestly, power was never absolute. But in the early 17th century, that was truer than ever. With the central throne reduced to a rumor, the periphery, so to speak, stepped in. Pious marabouts were loud in their preachings of righteousness that naturally opposed the Saadians. Tribal leaders were just as set in denouncing the dynastic chaos that was sucking the life out of the land, and were also placing their own odds. So, for example, the city of Fes, Morocco's spiritual heart, so to speak, threw its support behind Zidane. Marrakech, on its hand, the Saadian seat of power, literally, was backing Abu Faris for a while before switching gears. And as if that wasn't enough, in the distance, just beyond the borders, or perhaps already inside them, stood the great powers of the age, waiting like a patient storm, gathering politely offshore, if you may. You guessed it, European interest poking at the horizon, as always. On one hand, Spain was still pretty swollen with pride from all the claiming of Muslim territories it had done during the Reconquista, and it was now asserting itself across the Mediterranean. So naturally, it started to gaze again across the Strait of Jabal Tariq with imperial appetite. On the other hand, the Ottoman Empire, which had become seasoned in the art of subtle domination, had already turned North Africa outside of Morocco into its diplomatic chessboard. Morocco had always managed to avoid becoming a Turkish province, but their presence loomed large nonetheless, a distant sultan in a distant capital, reminding everyone that autonomy was rarely absolute. All in all, in 17th century Morocco, the land remained Moroccan in name, but the game that was being played upon it, increasingly, was not. And it was against this backdrop of dynastic weakening and external pressure that the word started to spread in 1610. L'Arèche, the strategic port town, gateway to the Atlantic, and symbol of Moroccan independence, had fallen. It had been yielded to Spain. And do not be mistaken, as the city hadn't surrendered to the roar of cannons or to the march of soldiers, but to something far less romantic, a transaction. It was a deal brokered by one of the Saadian contenders, once a prince, son of Ahmed al-Mansur himself, Mohammed Sheikh al-Mamun. This gambler had wagered the country's sovereignty in exchange for soldiers, Spanish army aid, in his final desperate fight for the throne, a self-inflicted wound. The outrage that this event caused burned in the mosques, in the markets, across villages, that were now watching their leaders make deals with foreign powers, like the next merchant. People developed a longing for purification, for a return to something unspoiled by political appetite. And as we know, in such times, people stop seeking reformers altogether. Instead, they ask for saviors, messiahs, to reinstate their honor. As the Saadian state began to weaken, some zawiyas had grown into centers of great power. Spiritual, sure, but also political and military, commanding allegiance from entire tribes. And it was in this environment, rich in religious legitimacy, but fractured in political authority, that Abu Mahalli would emerge. His actual full name was Abu Mahalli al-Filali al-Sijilmasi, and in 17th century Morocco, that name already carried weight. Abu Mahalli traced his lineage directly back to Sid al-Abbas, an uncle of the Prophet, peace be upon him. Some genealogists thought his tribe, the Ulad Mahalli, belonged to the Maghrawa, and others to the Lemtouna, which are two major Amazigh tribes in North Africa. There are many attempts to reconcile these views, but what we care about is that history remembered a prophetic lineage, so to speak. Or at the very least, a claimed one, as it wasn't something you could easily verify back then. You guessed it, this narrative bestowed upon him legitimacy, a sort of secret current that no aspirant to the throne could do without at the time. But it isn't in the Sultan's palace that his story begins, among the marble fountains of Qasr al-Badia, the magnificent home of Ahmed al-Mansur. Nope. Abu Mahalli's story begins somewhere quieter. According to Moroccan historian Ifrani, Abu Mahalli was born in the year 1559 or 1560 in Sijilmassa, a storied city from the Tafilalt region. Once a jewel on the Trans-Saharan trade route, the city's glory had faded by the 17th century, its name all but replaced by Tafilalt. Sijilmassa had been a melting pot before anyone used the term, a place where Amazigh, Arab, Jewish, and sub-Saharan merchants traded gold and salt alongside books and prayers. A good place to learn how the word worked, if you ask me. Abu Mahalli was described by historical records as a pious and introspective man. He received his first education from his father, a respected jurist in his hometown. His family was known for scholarship and judicial service, which is why they got nicknamed Children of the Qadi. According to the chronicles of the Saadian dynasty, his mother dreamt of a saint offering her milk during pregnancy, which apparently symbolized religious knowledge. Interesting. Anywho, in 1572 or 1573, like it was customary to do for aspiring scholars back then, he left his birthplace and moved to Fes, the intellectual heartbeat of the Maghreb region, where he sat with the brightest scholars. Abu Mahalli spent a couple diligent years studying grammar before immersing himself in Islamic sciences. He took a couple teachers from the University of Al-Qarawiyyin, and initially Abu Mahalli was very skeptical of a specific type of scholar, the Sufis, whom he saw as corrupt. But it just so happens that the very man that was responsible for his spiritual awakening was none other than the leader of a respected Sufi order. This man, who went by the name Sidi Muhammad bin Mubarak al-Zairi, took Abu Mahalli as his disciple. The latter had followed the path of the master so closely that, and I quote, he came to possess grace to a certain degree, so much so that upon leaving Fes to make his way back home in the Tafilalt region, Abu Mahalli was symbolically handed the instruments of spiritual transmission by his master Zairi. Before saying goodbyes and parting ways, the latter left him with his stick, his burnous, his shoes, and placed a religious hat on his disciple's head. Sufism isn't your typical school of thought, as its teachings often demand more than just memorization. They require a certain level of transformation through quiet discipline, fasts, inward battles. It completely rewires a brain. It shakes a man, it cleanses a soul. And so Abu Mahali was transformed out of dust, hunger, verses of the Quran he memorized under oil lamps that smoked way more than they shone. But if his ascetic lifestyle made him live on the margins of society, it didn't turn him blind to what was going down around him. Truth is, were you the most willing of all Moroccans back then? There was really nothing that could make you ignore the winds of change that were blowing. But graduating from that lifestyle did not ignite Abu Mahali's political ambitions just yet. What did was accomplishing a pilgrimage to Mecca for Al-Hajj, the ritual completion of faith in Islam. And it was upon his return from his travel to the heart of Dar al-Islam that something in him truly changed, or rather, stepped forward. The humility he had built through years and years of immersion into the Sufi lifestyle kind of turned into harsh certitude. He made the same diagnosis we made earlier together. He saw the chaos for himself and blamed Sayyidin for it. Criticized the civil wars of Ahmed al-Mansur's sons, called them out for being irresponsible heretics wrapped in silk, started speaking of purity, of jihad, of restoration. And these beliefs, these opinions, had been hardened into destiny. He became widely known as a jurisconsult and a preacher, writing several works, and was described as an elegant writer with lofty ideas. Though apparently his poetry was considered mediocre, which I'm curious to see how one can sound mediocre in Arabic, if that's even possible. But most importantly, he saw himself as a moral reformer, which ironically led him to his political ruin. And that ruin started the second he moved to Wadi Suwara, where he would have allegedly experienced some sort of divine awakening or inspiration, which led him to declare himself Mahdi, a divinely guided messianic redeemer in Islamic eschatology. Not as a metaphor nor a figure of speech, but as a call. The guy felt it in his bones. He was the chosen one, meant to rise before the end of time and restore justice in a world crooked by Sa'diyyin depravity. Now, I know how this sounds, and I can almost hear you say it. This guy is nuts. And maybe you're not that far off, actually, because as soon as he made that messianic claim, some former supporters of his, like Abu al-Abbas Hamid al-Tawati, started distancing themselves from him. But me personally, I don't think he was mad at all. He was methodical, let's just say. Calling himself Mahdi, the guided one, was probably the result of a mix between arrogance, sure, a lot of it, and also necessity. In a world that was falling apart, the man who pretends to be the savior may well become one. So we can talk about audacity all day, but the proof's in the pudding, it worked. He entered in correspondence with tribal leaders and city elites and urged them to follow Sunnah and to recognize his divine mission, emphasizing the corruption of the age. But if he wanted to make his claim of being Mahdi credible in the eyes and the ears of the believers who knew what it took to be one, Abu Mahali had to claim to be a Fatimite, a descendant of Fatima, the daughter of the Prophet, peace be upon him. Even bolder was the claim that he made, according to Moroccan historian Ifrani, that his followers were superior to Sahaba, the Prophet's very companions, because, and I quote, they rose in an age of darkness. As you can imagine, this extreme rhetoric and all these inflated claims were also heavily criticized. Scholars like Abu Zakaria Yahya ibn Abdullah made poetry and sermons pointing fingers at him, calling him a fraud. But let's be clear, in an age and in a Morocco that was already super thick with religious fervor, the guy was electric. Allegedly, Abu Mahali would have started his political endeavor by instigating the assassination of Prince Muhammad al-Sheikh al-Mamun, the son of Ahmed al-Mansour by writing letters to two muqaddimin, so two military commanders, Ahmed bin Qais and Muhammad Abu Layth. These commanders killed the prince and robbed him from his wealth, which included no less than two containers full of rubies. They stocked all of his belongings in a fully loaded ship in Tanja, which, as fate would have it, would later get seized by Christian pirates. And the reason why Abu Mahalli instigated, allegedly, the assassination of Al-Mamun leads us back to Larish, that small city that had been carrying the weight of betrayal because of the prince's decisions. It was that town that truly gave him his moment. The people's bitterness became his weapon. When Muhammad al-Sheikh al-Mamun sold Larish to the Christians, Abu Mahalli was enraged. And he also tapped into the people's anger, the humiliation, the sense that the country had been hollowed out by weak men in robes. So what did he do? He called for jihad against both the Spaniards on the coast and the Saadian rulers themselves, whom he designated as the true architects of Morocco's ruin. His cry offered something that the people of Morocco hadn't heard in years: certainty. And in a land dizzy from civil war, that certainty, however dangerous, felt like salvation, especially when it was calling for a return to something clean under God's sky. Abu Mahalli's first major act was to take his birthplace, Sijil Massa, in 1610. With only 400 fighters, according to the records, he defeated the lieutenant of Zidane, one of the princes who was claiming the throne, and his 4,000-strong army. After the victory, he was welcomed in his hometown with open arms and faced no resistance whatsoever in implementing reforms. Symbolically, it meant everything: a fallen trade city reborn as his capital. But most importantly was the strategy part. It gave him control over a key node of desert trade. Abu Mahalli started to receive delegations from Tlemcen in present-day Algeria and a territory Ifrani referred to as the Banu Rashid, which I assume is present-day Barshid, where the Hriz represent. From there, he moved up into the Dra Valley, and in that region, his enemy wasn't Zidane, but Zidane's brother, Abdullah bin Mansur, who was sent to stop this Mahdi/warlord. But that ended up being a huge fail. Nearly 3,000 of his soldiers were killed by Abu Mahalli's men, which gave him control of the entire south. The next step of his journey would be the most defining. Abu Mahalli was going to march on the capital, Marrakesh. A funny quote-unquote prophet in boots setting his eyes on the red city that was once built for saints and caliphs only. What a plot twist. And it was Qaid Yunus Laisi, a man who had once served Prince Zidane before joining Mahalli's cause, that pushed him to do it. Abu Mahalli successfully made it inside the city walls. And the thing is, it was Zidane al-Nasir who held Marrakesh at the time, but no one was really buying it. The Saadian court, as we touched on earlier, was split, distracted, tired. And so when Abu Mahalli approached with his army, there was no great defense of dynastic pride, no last stand. 2 + 2 = 4. The gates of the capital opened and the city fell without a battle. This fail led Zidane to flee, tail between his legs, towards the port of Esfi, while Abu Mahalli was entering the imperial palace. And this is where we get on even shakier ground, historically speaking, than before. Word has it that he may have married Zidane's own mother, had a child with her, and named his newborn son Zidane, as if he was trying to reclaim through fatherhood what he had taken by force, which honestly makes for a Freudian twist so creepy that I don't think history dared verify it. Abu Mahalli, comfortable and well established on his new throne, pulled the usual royal move of minting coins in Marrakesh, in Al-Ktawa, back home in Sijil Massa, but he did so with a certain messianic flair. The coins read, and I quote, "Ornament of the Vice-Regency of the prophet. But here begins the great irony, right? Because let's be honest, this story would be quite boring if it didn't take a paradoxical turn. The man who once called for religious purification was now missing his prayers. The one who had spoken of divine clarity was now scribbling decrees like a drunk caliph, fat with flattery. Just like many rulers, Marrakesh and the mightiest capitals of the world had seen before him, his faith, once pure, was now a ceremonial robe, a facade. And it was one specific event that got him back to his senses. According to Moroccan chronicler Ifrani, one day, an old Sufi companion or friend of his came to see him as he was made aware of how deluded Abu Mahali was becoming. So he told him a story which made for an allegorical warning, where he compared political power to a ball made of rags, fought over with harm for little value. Abu Mahali listened, and that apparently woke him up, because filled with guilt, he would have said in a piercing cry, and I quote, "We tried to revive religion, and now we have destroyed it." And so he ruled for a while as something between a prince and a prophet. He had become the face of a people that was sick of political intrigue, disappointed by Saidian rule. He was seen by many as a divine correction. He pressed pause temporarily on the Saidian beef, at least within the walls of Marrakesh. But in doing so, he introduced something far more unpredictable into Moroccan life, an untested theology of power. And Morocco, always a step ahead of certainty, shifted again. Because Zid al-Nasser, still licking his wounds in exile, hadn't said his last words yet. He still had allies scattered across the territory. One of them was a man with influence of another kind, most likely a marabout, and his name was Sheikh Yahya ibn Abdullah. Zidane wrote to him, the last man who might still believe in crowns made of something other than smoke. Yahya ibn Abdullah had his own network and his own authority, and crucially, he made a cause out of the idea of driving Abu Mahali out of Marrakesh. He gathered men of rough hands, warriors from Banu Jarrar, Hashtuka, and other places, most likely an Amazigh army. From his palace in Marrakesh, Abu Mahali was made aware of Yahya ibn Abdullah's plans. And so he replied, sending Yahya a defiant letter where he compared himself to a lion and called his rival a cowardly jackal. Yeah, to which Yahya replied that God alone owns power, after which they set the final battle on a site called Jilz near the capital. From a dynastic crisis, Morocco was now the theater of a clash between two men, both cloaked in religious authority, both claiming they held the key to Morocco's future, only for it to not even be a proper battle in the end. The final confrontation took place on October the 22nd, 1613. And trust me, I know Marrakesh had seen many, many, many battles by this point, but something tells me this one must have felt different. One, because the battle, when it came, was surprisingly short. For all its build-up, two visions of Morocco quote-unquote colliding, it ended almost at once. In the early moments, a single bullet found Abu Mahdi's chest, a sharp sound, a deafening silence. He died instantly, and that was it. No divine shield, no descending angel, no beam of light announcing the departure of his soul. The self-declared Mahdi, who had burst into Marrakesh with the weight of prophecy behind him and who had played his entire thing on it, was being brought down like any other mortal. And with that, the spell broke. His men faltered in disbelief, literally fleeing as their leader's claim to invincibility had dissolved in seconds before their eyes. How could a man under God's protection fall so easily?
That question, eternally unanswered, though we might have that answer today, drained the fight out of them. The army scattered like people waking up from a dream they're embarrassed to admit they needed. And the rest of the movement collapsed in utter confusion. What followed was comically quick, almost theatrical. First, Marrakesh was left with the old rhythm of power reasserting itself. The city returned to Saadian hands, as history's doors often swing back to the last people standing. Second, and this is the morbid part, Abu Mahali's head was displayed, cut off, at the gate of the royal palace, held high as a warning. Word has it, it stayed on the walls of Marrakesh for 12 whole years. Apparently, later on, his head was finally buried with some dignity in the mausoleum of Abu Labbas al-Sibti. One Moroccan scholar, clever as only scholars can be in retrospect, summed it all up in a single line, and I quote, "He rose a goat and died a ram." Some of his followers insisted that Abu Mahali did not die, but simply disappeared. In Wadi Swara, the place where it all started, they say he just waits for his time to come back again. And of course they would say that. We never bury our legends, not really. All we do is hide them until we need them again. And so, what of Yahya ibn Abdullah? Well, him and his men entered Marrakesh victorious, but cautious, and rightfully so, because Prince Zidane, restored in his authority, wrote to him to thank him, sure, for his service, but mostly hinting that power was not meant to be shared, and that if it was, he did not intend on doing so with him. The message was pretty clear, and so Yahya just packed his bags, probably a tad disappointed that he got nothing from his investment in the Saadian Hrera, but it doesn't really matter, does it? He simply returned to his domain in the mountains for now, and Zidane to his throne, and the people to their routines, which is what they always do when the currents of history tire them the F out. The fake Mahdi was dead, his rule had been temporary, and the Saadian dynasty, though very much exhausted, was not. A final bloodied full stop. Abu Mahali's rise and fall were too fast for proper historical analysis to be made, but just long enough to mean something. Because when there's a vacuum, history ends up producing men like Abu Mahali. Men with conviction in a time of exhaustion. And 17th century Morocco was ready to believe, to hand their hops to someone who claimed he had come from God, despite fully knowing that the last true men of that kind had died 1,000 years ago in Medina. And even he, at the end, had died as a human being, back to God. The thing is, we always know, but we still believe anyways. That too is history, and perhaps also forgiveness.